This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Lebanese officials said 9 people died and nearly 3,000 were wounded on Tuesday when pagers they were carrying exploded. An operation a militant group Hezbollah is blaming on Israel.
The alleged Israeli attack increased tensions further between Israel and Lebanon. Local officials near the Israeli border called on residents to stay close to bomb shelters, fearing a Hezbollah response. The pager explosions came after Israel's security cabinet voted to expand the aims of the almost year-old war to include the return of the 60,000 Israelis who were forced to flee their homes along the northern border. More than 100,000 have fled on the Lebanese side of the border. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
IPI correspondent Haya Panjwani reports on Donald Trump's first campaign appearance since his second assassination attempt.
Trump held a town hall in Michigan, moderated by Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders, his former White House press secretary. During the event, he addressed his assassination attempt.
And then you wonder why I get shot at, right? You know, only consequential presidents get shot at. When I say something like that, you have countries saying, this guy, but... What can you do? You have to do what you have to do, right?
Trump repeated false claims that Chinese automakers are putting up large factories in Mexico. He also said that he'll be meeting with Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi next week. I'm Haya Panjwani.
Yemen's Houthi rebels have shot down 2 American MQ-9 Reaper drones in under a week, further highlighting the regional spread of the Israel-Hamas war. The United States military said Wednesday that the Houthis shot down the first Reaper September 10th, the second on Monday. Online video showed the downing and the flaming wreckage on the ground. This is VOA News. A new Microsoft threat intelligence report details how Russia-linked actors are now going full throttle in their covert influence efforts against Vice President Kamala Harris. The report released Tuesday shows how, after a slow start, groups linked to the Kremlin have redoubled their commitment to swaying U.S. political opinion as the election nears. The report details fake videos that racked up millions of views across social media that see disinformation about the Democratic presidential nominee. The report builds on previous U.S. concerns about Russian interference in the upcoming election. Harris's campaign declined to comment. The Russian embassy did not respond to requests for comment. Human rights groups have urged Britain not to copy Italy's approach in trying to reduce the number of migrants arriving on its shores, with a surge of people arriving on small boats across the English Channel. Henry Ridgewell reports for VOA.
Prime Minister Keir Starmer travelled to Italy Monday to learn from its recent success in cutting migration across the Mediterranean from North Africa.
Irregular arrivals to Italy by sea are down 60% since 2022. So I'm pleased that we're deepening our cooperation here.
Italy has struck multi-million dollar deals with Libya and Tunisia to stop migrants leaving their shores. Human rights groups accuse those countries of committing widespread abuses against migrants. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
AP correspondent Margie Zarletta reports on a judge ordering musician Sean Diddy Combs to be jailed in sex trafficking and a racketeering case.
U.S. Magistrate Robin Tarnovsky refused a proposal from Sean Diddy Combs' defense to release him on a $50 million bond to home detention. Prosecutors say Combs drugged and abused women, then used his vast resources to cover up the crimes. Combs has pleaded not guilty. His attorney, Mark Agnifilo, said outside court the case stems from a consensual relationship.
He didn't do these things. This was a 10-year relationship. There's no coercion. There's no crime.
Agnifilo did not name the woman, but the details match those of Combs' relationship with singer Cassie Ventura.
And that is a piece of Margie Zarletta reporting. Thousands of activists and opposition leaders from the Bangladesh Nationalist Party have rallied in the capital, demanding on Tuesday a democratic transition through an election. The interim government has not yet set a voting time frame. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Muhammad Yunus became interim leader after the former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina fled during a mass uprising. More at VOAnews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, everyone. Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's army says it foiled an attack by extremists on a military training camp in the capital Bamako on Tuesday.
They're referring to the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group called JNIM. That's the group that claimed responsibility. They are, in fact, the authors of this attack.
South Sudan eyes the resumption of oil production. We'll examine factors that could impact Senegal's November 17 parliamentary elections. Authorities are trying to tackle Nairobi's worsening air pollution. The WHO says cancer kills millions each year despite efforts to tackle the disease. The commander of the U.S. Africa Command discusses AFRICOM's mission and challenges.
A number of layered threats that our African partners have to contend with that challenges their aspirations for stability and security.
Haitians in Ohio react to allegations that they are eating residents' cats and dogs. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mali's army said the country's capital, Bamako, was back to normal on Tuesday afternoon after extremists attacked a military training camp in Bamako. Reuters said an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group claimed responsibility for the attack. VOA's Carol Van Dam spoke with Michael Shokin, the director of global programs at the intelligence firm 14 North Strategies, about the attack in Bamako.
They're referring to the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group called JNIM. That's the group that claimed responsibility. They are, in fact, the authors of this attack.
Is the country, just in general, many more stable now, given this latest attack now than it was the time these military rulers forcibly took control of Mali?
No, it's not any more under control than it was before. I mean, one thing I really want to stress is, you know, right now the military junta is going to say, yeah, this is great. This was a success. We stopped the attacks and we prevented the attackers from achieving their objectives. But immediately that meme that we've all seen comes to mind where there's that cartoon character sitting and drinking coffee and everything's on fire around him and he's saying, this is fine. That's what the junta is saying, because the situation really is not fine. And what's been going on is that despite vigorous efforts by the Malian military and its Russian paramilitary helpers to degrade JNIM, clearly it is not. I mean, the attack suggests that JNIM is not degraded. The fact that they planned this in advance. This is well planned. They sent people in to sort of prepare the way, and they were able to mount this attack. All of it was under the nose of the Malian regime. I mean, this is true across the board, where attacks have remained, by and large, constant, but they remain constant notwithstanding or despite all of the efforts by the Malian government to do things. Meanwhile, the JNIM is able to do this attack. And I want to stress that at the same time in northeastern Mali, Islamic State is running rampant over large chunks of Malian territory.
And as you point out, in all these different places, big areas of Mali, this kind of violence is still going on. What's behind the violence? What's causing it?
There's a lot that's going on. I mean, first of all, you have like hardcore ideological jihadists that want to impose an Islamist regime. That's one element. Another element is that you have longstanding issues having to do with inter-ethnic and intercommunal conflicts. These are conflicts that often are related to perennial conflicts between herders and farmers, competition for natural resources. We have a rapidly growing population, so the competition is getting even greater. Plus, you have the fact that the government has been doing a terrible job of trying to manage all these conflicts and deal with these things. And just lack of governance or bad governance and growing competition for resources. And I think this is what's driving most of the fighters to join the Islamist group. In other words, it's probably the case that most of these combatants are not, in fact, ideologically or religiously motivated. And they've rallied to the flag of jihad because this is a way to move forward. They see this as an opportunity to try to advance their personal interests, their communal interests.
That was Michael Shokin, Director of Global Programs at the intelligence firm 14 North Strategies. He was speaking with viewers Carol Van Dam. The commander of the U.S. Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM, says the organization is focused on partnering with African nations to combat violent extremist organizations, transnational criminal groups, and the security impacts of climate change. General Michael Langley briefed the journalists last week at the State Department. He spoke one-on-one with journalist Paul Matibe about cooperation with African countries and some of the challenges.
On the African continent, a number of layered threats that our African partners have to contend with that challenges their aspirations for stability and security, which in both of those you can affect prosperity across civil society. So I consider that a shared challenges. So when I look at overall what I need to do to be able to execute a campaign with our partners and collaborate with them in engagements to decide what the way forward and what are the prescriptions to be able to address these challenges or these layered threats, I found out that it wasn't binary because there's other players. There's other players and outside the continent, and I'm talking about some of the aspirations of the PRC, some of the aspirations of the Russian Federation, irrespective of this rules-based international order. It produced a malign influence in some countries that has been destabilizing, whether it be from misinformation campaigns or being able to unfair practices of in some of these countries, whether it be mining concessions or unbalanced loans. So all those things that our African partners contend with to reach the shared objectives, I need to be able to understand the challenges they have in building their economy, institutionalizing their governments against the headwinds of these other external challenges. Last week, I spent time in East Africa, specifically in Somalia, meeting with President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed and his chief of defense, General Mujahideen. And we came together. There's a coalition of a number of countries that's called the Coalition of Against Terrorism and stay in for a stabilization activities. I met with them from the security construct, but also because we are a 3D command that harnesses defense from DOD.
General Michael Langley is the commander of the U.S. Africa Command, also known as AFRICOM. He spoke with journalist Paul Matibe at the Pentagon. Senegal's president, Bassirou Diomaye Faye, last week announced snap elections after he dissolved the country's parliament. Reuters quotes analysts as saying that Senegal's slower economic growth, widening fiscal deficit, and a potential delay in International Monetary Fund financing could cloud the outlook ahead of the November 17th parliamentary elections. Renee Lake is a political analyst and the director of CinePlus.com, a U.S.-based media group. He tells VS Douglas Umpuga that although economic issues are real, they will not be the key deciding factor in this year's parliamentary election.
The 2 months is a little surprising, but what is not a surprise was the fact that President Diomaye have decided to dissolve the National Assembly, the parliament. The law allowed him to do that after 2 years, and that was the 12th of August when they decided was the mark of the 2 years. So he immediately decided to dissolve the assembly, and basically he had 3 months to organize the election, so he did it pretty early, 2 months, that's really close. That was a surprise. A lot of people didn't expect to be that close. All of this was basically expected because for Diomaye Faye and Ousmane Sonko, the most important at this point was to have a majority in the parliament in order to implement their program.
Given Senegal's current political and economic situation, was this a wise move in your opinion?
Yes, it really depends on who answers the question. And if from the opposition side, yes, they would say it wasn't a wise move because it created a tension in the country, it created even a form of instability, the country being without a parliament to vote the different law and especially the budget. And also The fact that the election is on the November 17 will not allow to have what is called the parrainage, which is basically the candidacy to be validated by a certain number of citizens of the country. So for those reasons, the opposition obviously will think that this was not a wise move. But from Joe Maïfaï and Ousmane Sonko and his party, the movement PASTEF, obviously it was a good move, because it will certainly allow them to get the majority of the parliament and being able to implement their political program.
According to some analysts, economic disparities were a big issue in the last election. How do you think they will affect this parliamentary elections?
Yeah, I don't know if economic disparities were a big issue at the last election. So for this parliamentary election, I don't think those aspects either going to play a role. I think it will be really political issues, really about giving the executive, the legislative mean to implement their program.
That was Renee Lake, the director of SenePlus.com. He spoke with VOA's Douglas Mpuga from Arusha, Tanzania. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 18th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. An advisor to the economic cluster has criticized the Ministry of Finance for sending political statements to South Sudanese who are looking for solutions to the country's economic crisis. The Minister of Finance said Monday his office is working to improve the economy by using several measures, including the resumption of crude oil export through Sudan. For VOA News, Dennis Logoyi reports from Juba.
South Sudanese are struggling with serious economic challenges, mainly due to hyperinflation. Finance Minister Mariel Dongrin Atter yesterday outlined steps aimed at addressing the country's poor economic performance.
These measures are aimed at improving tax revenue mobilization, enhancing crude oil export, securing funding, digitalization and financial inclusion, and fostering food security.
Abraham Alit Mamer, an economist and advisor to the country's economic cluster, called the minister solutions political maneuvering.
You know, economic measures or economic principle or any economic work, it will take some time for it to cushion. When you do things in economics, you incubate them. When you are incubating them, it will take time to grow. So somebody better in the office for 2 months would have less to do what is really happening now. So that is from the economic perspective. But politically, yes, you know, as a politician, you can claim anything that sounds positive.
South Sudan depends on oil for its GDP. However, the conflict in Sudan disrupted oil flow, causing major economic hardships in both countries. Dongrin says President Salva Kiir and Sudan's military leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, met on Monday to discuss the resumption of South Sudan's oil production.
On the resumption of Dar blend in terms of production and export, we received the President of Sudan, General Burhan, and one of the issues discussed by our President with him is the issue of the resumption of the Dar blend. And as I mentioned, there has been a breakthrough, and it will come to public soon.
In March, the Sudanese government announced the suspension of South Sudan's oil exports through Sudanese territories because of a fault in the pipelines. Mamer cautions South Sudanese against counting on the newly introduced measures to turn things around until the oil starts flowing.
It is not the first time it is being said. It has been said a number of times. Every minister of finance, minister of petroleum, anybody in the government will say that when our delegation went to Port Sudan and they met and they were talking about this thing. So in terms of politics, yes, you can say that.
Proceeds from oil account for about 90% of the South Sudan's revenue. South Sudan has been sending about 150,000 barrels of crude oil per day through Sudan for export since 2011. As of September 16th, 2024, the price of West Texas Intermediate, WTI, crude oil was $70.50 per barrel. The price of Brent crude oil was $72.61 per barrel on September 17th, 2024. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logoni reporting from Juba.
Authorities in Nairobi are trying to tackle the Kenyan capital's chronic and worsening air pollution. With help from the U.S. Agency for International Development, authorities are placing sensors that can monitor air quality around the densely populated city. Victoria Amuga reports from Nairobi.
Dense traffic and dirty fuel emissions characterize some of the Kenyan capital's streets. The city is home to at least 5 million people. And with the growing numbers, local authorities say the air quality is declining. Geoffrey Mosiria is the chief environment officer in Nairobi.
Many vehicles use diesel and petrol. They are emitting a lot of chemicals, the gases into the air. And also we have industries. Some of them are built in residential area.
Residents like Eunice Chuli, a vendor in Nairobi, bear the brunt of the situation. Chuli says she often falls sick. She believes it's because of the dirty air that she's exposed to here daily.
Recently I had a coughing issue. I was coughing very seriously. I had to go to a hospital to be checked. Yeah, I was under medication for a whole.
It's a situation that the authorities here are beginning to deal with. The first step is to install air quality monitors around the city. The monitors' inlets pick up particles in the air. Larger fragments are screened out, leaving the thin bits to flow to a filter. The head of air quality at the World Resources Institute, George Mwaniki, explains that the system measures particles which are usually dangerous to the human body.
And they come to a filter here where they are impacted, and then the machine has a very sensitive weighing machine that it weighs every 1 minute what is the changes in terms of the weight of the filter.
The collected data is sent out for real-time analysis. At least 37 monitors have been set up so far. The initiative is funded by the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, for over $1.5 million. The agency's spokesperson says the data will help the government target clean air interventions where they are most needed and evaluate their effectiveness. According to a 2020 report, more than 5,000 premature deaths in Kenya are caused each year by air pollution. Respiratory disease specialist Dr. Jared Mecha says diseases that result from pollution are a matter of growing concern.
You have cough that we cannot explain. Then we also have actually cancers of the upper airway.
With the air monitoring devices, Nairobi joins 10 global cities that are working towards clean air by gathering data. People interviewed by VOA say possible solutions for Nairobi include the adoption of electric vehicles, greater control of industrial emissions, and the proper collection and disposal of garbage. Residents like Chuli hope that lasting improvements to the air quality can be found soon. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
At least 10 million people die globally each year due to cancer. The World Health Organization says millions of cases and deaths are attributed to tobacco, alcohol, fossil fuels, and ultra-processed foods. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
One in five people develop cancer in their lifetime, and approximately one in nine men and one in 12 women die from the disease. Statistics from the World Health Organization indicate that between 19 and 33 million cancer cases and deaths are as a result of industrial activities and lifestyle. The Cancer Congress aims to strengthen participants' action to fight cancer at national, regional, and international levels. The experts are showcasing successful interventions related to cancer prevention, diagnosis, treatment, and care. Carrie Adams is the chief executive officer at the Union for International Cancer Control.
World Cancer Congress is organized for the cancer community around the world to get together to exchange ideas and best practice and motivate each other to make a difference in cancer control in their country.
According to the WHO, most countries do not adequately finance priority cancer and palliative care services as part of universal health coverage. The WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says millions of people still die from cancer despite the progress being made to tackle the disease.
In the time it takes me to make these remarks, almost 40 people will die with cancer somewhere in our world. More than 27,000 every day and 10 million a year. Yet, there are reasons to be optimistic.
He says the WHO is focusing on key areas of progress and ongoing challenges in tackling cervical, childhood and breast cancers, as well as the importance of integrating palliative care into cancer care. In Africa alone, cancer cases are on the rise, with approximately 1,949 lives lost to cancer each day. The WHO projects that there will be a 70% increase in new cancer cases by 2030 in the region due to factors such as population growth, aging exposure to carcinogen agents, and unhealthy lifestyles, among other factors. Zainab Bagudu, a board member at the Union for International Cancer Control, says addressing cancer health disparities in African population should be a priority.
Cancer control is a team effort. It's not about the oncologists and the special scientists. We have patient advocates there. We have civil society. We have pharma. We have people from everywhere that are doing so many good things.
The WHO predicts that there will be over 35 million new cancer cases in 2050, a 77% increase from the estimated 20 million cases in 2022. And the World Health Organization says much of that is associated with socioeconomic development. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
A small town in the Midwestern state of Ohio finds itself at the center of a controversy involving fake news about migrants eating residents' pet cats and dogs. VOA Creole traveled to Springfield and has this report narrated by Elizabeth Chernoff.
Haitian migrants living in Springfield, a small town in the Midwestern state of Ohio, are making headlines nationwide after being accused of eating residents' pets. The allegation, posted on social media and amplified by the Republican vice presidential nominee, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance, was repeated in last week's debate by former President Donald Trump, sparking outrage. Haitian migrants in Ohio, like Cleo, deny the allegations.
I saw it on the internet. People talking about all Haitians are misbehaving, but definitely there is no proof. Anyway, I don't walk around town.
Although local authorities confirm there is no evidence of migrants eating pets, the rumor has prompted numerous bomb threats, forcing school closures, and is negatively affecting Haitians' lives in Springfield. Baptiste is a Haitian migrant here.
Since we are Haitian, when news like that is published in the media, it scares us. We are just searching for a better life.
Another Haitian migrant who spoke to VOA on the condition of anonymity for security reasons says an angry resident pulled a knife on him.
So, manage your telephone, man.
I got a phone call and I step outside with a friend. We are just standing and I saw a guy's truck. I wasn't even touching it. And he came out and asked, "What are you doing?" We said, "We are just standing and we are not leaning on your truck." The guy's truck, he posed like he was ready to fight. And his wife told us, "Just leave, go back inside." So we ignore him and left. But what really stunned me is the guy turn and say, "You Asians." Then he pull a knife on me.
Brian Heck is the Springfield city manager.
Springfield is a dynamic community with many positive attributes. It is disappointing that some of the narrative surrounding our city has been skewed by misinformation circulating on social media and further amplified by political rhetoric in the current highly charged presidential election cycle.
The migrant issue is complicated. It goes beyond allegations of eating pets. There are more than 15,000 Haitian migrants living in Springfield, which has a total population of 60,000. Monte is a local resident who says the Haitian migrants are taking jobs from Americans.
Jobs are getting took up, man. You know, all these, you say our factory needs 50 people. That could be 50 Americans that don't have a job. Instead, the Haitians, they take exactly all those 50 spots, man. So that's 50 people that don't have a job.
Ernest is a customer service representative at Adasa Latin Market. He says over 70% of his customers are Haitian, and the influx of migrants has created some conflict with local residents.
This is a small town. People are narrow-minded in some areas. So I can see how they would feel that way. And it's also because people, like I said, like people don't know because of or the cultural differences, how to behave in certain manner.
One migrant says he was threatened after moving to Springfield from Florida 3 months ago. Now he's thinking about packing up and leaving town. For VOA Creole in Springfield, Ohio, Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News.
And that is it for this Wednesday, September 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington.